Welcome, everybody, to the AI Governance in Healthcare Best Practices, Solutions, and Unresolved Issues panel at Convi2X. Really appreciate your participation with us today. We've got a great panel with some very esteemed speakers, privileged to know and to have worked with some of you as well. I'll give a real quick intro for myself, and then we'll have some intros from the panel. So, my name is Dennis Chornicki. I'm the CEO of Dome Labs AI, a company that does AI advisory and builds some AI solutions and products, mostly in the healthcare space. And I'm also the chief AI advisor at UC Davis Health. Formerly, I was a senior advisor and presidential innovation fellow at the White House, and I've also served as the chief AI officer at United Health Group's Optum Health. I'm going to move over to some self-intros from the panel at this point. So maybe we'll just kind of go down as I've got you all in the window here, and we'll start, Calvin, with you.
Oh, sure. My name is Calvin Lawrence. I'm a distinguished engineer at the IBM Corporation. I have been working with AI for the last 6 or 7 years or so, but it goes back further with me. I actually got my master's degree in artificial intelligence, believe it or not, in the mid 90s, but it kind of died out. It was a kind of different type of AI, but today I spend my time mostly working in healthcare, state and local government, federal government, and in education. Actually hands-on, I'm a data scientist at heart, programmer, developer, type. So I've been spending my time really working on real life applications, building them, some good and some not so good around the ethical side. But welcome. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Wonderful. Thank you, Calvin. Yoav?
Thanks, Dennis. Hi, everyone. My name is Yoav Schlesinger. I'm an architect of ethical AI at Salesforce, which is a B2B platform CRM serving many of the Fortune 500 companies as a system of record for all their data management, service marketing, sales, health and life sciences, the range of all sort of back end processes. My remit at Salesforce is across all of our products, thinking about the responsible development and deployment of our AI systems, both predictive and generative. These days, a lot more on the generative side than predictive, but with the remit across ensuring coherence to our AI commitments, as well as trust, safety, security, and a range of other obligations that we have both for our customers as well as for society. So I'm really pleased to be here, sort of bringing the ethical and responsible AI lens to a conversation about healthcare. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful. Gil?
Hello, everyone. Great to be here. Thanks for having me. My name is Gil Trovitz, and I'm a faculty over at Harvard Medical School. For this panel, I'm really excited to be here and talk about some of the areas, you know, involved in my research. I've been working across different countries around sharing data and information to build those AI models for health applications, whether it be around ensuring that you can find drug-resistant variations related to bacteria to other applications. We'll stop there. Thanks.
Thanks. Thank you, Gil. Seth?
Sorry about that, trouble getting off of mute. Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm currently the founder and CEO of Quantum AI. It's an advisory firm helping organizations at the board and C-suite level define AI strategies, AI governance strategies, building organizational and technical capacity, focused on equity firms and the Fortune 500. Prior to that, I was the president of the Responsible AI Institute, and prior to that, I was the first global chief AI officer at IBM. And before that, I led the data and AI transformation of Monsanto. You might be wondering what I'm doing here in a healthcare conversation. I have a PhD in psychiatric genetics, So during the tail end of the Human Genome Project, which is where I got into this whole field of machine learning, which was when we figured, we said, what do we do with these, you know, sometimes gigabytes or, you know, hundreds of gigabytes of data? That was our dissertation project. So I've been doing this for about 20 some odd years.
Wonderful. Well, we're so glad and grateful to have such a great panel here today. Thank you all again. I've got some questions that I'd like to jump into, and I'll just ask them kind of generally and let you know, any one of you jump in as you feel. So first question that I think is probably on a lot of folks' minds right now has to do with this rapid adoption of generative AI technologies, or maybe not even adoption, but let's say kind of rapid proliferation of the conversation of interest. Maybe not as rapid adoption in healthcare, there are a lot of interest, but rapid adoption broadly. I think we've seen that OpenAI's ChatGPT was the fastest company to hit, our fastest application to hit 100 million users, knocking TikTok off of that pedestal recently. And so with this rise of you know, hype, interest, discussion, early adoption at this point of generative AI in healthcare, what governance challenges or new governance challenges do you, do any of you believe that this poses for healthcare systems and kind of, you know, healthcare in general?
I mean, I'll start off first person. I think the biggest challenge is really the around generative AI is just the complexity of the technology itself. I think sometimes, you know, technologies like ChatGPT that has been in design for a couple of years or so kind of simplify it in a way where these large language models are not really simple at all. Because, like, unlike traditional software that, you know, operated on these like clearly defined set of rules or parameters like Java, like I'm a Java guy, right? So there's this set of rules. Generative AI is designed from the ground up to really to be creative and innovative in itself. So the whole concept of being able to pull data from lots of places and crunch that data makes establishing guidelines like very, very difficult, right? Because there's so much unstructured kind of a view of it because of the innovation. You want folk to be innovative. So I think that in itself, you know, around the whole concept of these models being trained with lots and lots of data, much of it, as I said earlier, is uncurated, it makes it very, very difficult. So for me, the biggest challenge in itself is the simplification of a very complex set of technology. And those of us who've been in programming a long time knows, like, when you're actually building these systems, you know, it's very difficult. And then the transparency, and then for me, the lack of human oversight are those three things that I would say are key, especially in critical areas like healthcare.
And I think there's some core underlying issues with the technology. So the technology has been around in development since 2017, 2018. It's based on a concept called foundation models, which is based on a concept called, the transformer models. And the reason these technologies have some of the issues we've been seeing is how they function. So in ChatGPT, when it first came out, we heard lots about hallucinations and lots about bias and hate and misogyny coming out in the models. The hallucinations is a foundational part of these models. I would push back on anyone that says they can get rid of it altogether. It's just not possible. There's so many factors that play into this with this technology. So and that was very well understood by OpenAI when they released this, as was all the hate and misogyny and misinformation that lived in these models. You know, when you think about what, as Calvin alluded to, the data, you know, these models are trained on massively large data sets. So think the whole or most of the internet. GPT, which is the models that underlying ChatGPT, were trained initially on Reddit and books. Reddit is a great platform to teach math, you know, AI, how to simulate human conversation. It's a horrible place for to learn the information that is going on in those conversations. Because if you're not familiar with Reddit, there's all sorts of things that are called subreddits, where these conversations that really most people don't want to participate in because, you know, they're highly offensive at best. And then, you know, on top of that, you have, you know, inherent bias built into these models. And the way the data is collected goes afoul of almost every existing data privacy regulation that exists out there. In fact, the EU has already put OpenAI on notice that they're likely going to be some action against them. I imagine California and some of the other states will in the US will come after them as well. So there's just some core underlying issues that as an organization, you know, especially in healthcare, you need to be careful of. And that doesn't even get into what you saw with Samsung, where their proprietary information got trained into the model. With healthcare, that would be, you know, far worse, having people's personal health data trained into a model. So we need to be really mindful and thoughtful about how we leverage these models in any organization, but especially in healthcare.
The only thing I'll add to that, because I think both Calvin and Seth have made excellent points, is that some basic concepts of AI are not yet actualized in the generative AI context, right? So if you think about explainability, for example, which we've tried to unpack in the predictive or discriminative AI territory for years, is exponentially more difficult in the generative AI context. Things like model observability and monitoring for model drift, let's say, nearly impossible at this point, given the current state of the science, to evaluate and monitor. And so some of these very inchoate and sort of now operationalizable commitments around predictive and predictive AI just are uncharted waters for generative AI. The research science hasn't yet caught up to the data science, if you will, in order to support those explainability, transparency, and accountability types of requirements that we as a society hope that our AI can deliver on.
I think that's a really good point about the explainability, and that goes to, you know, the EU's approach to AI regulation, the EU AI Act, which was, you know, they were doing this before generative AI was on the scene fully, which is explaining the outcomes, which is really, really what we should do anyway, is, you know, look at disparate impact in the outcomes and things like that. Because as you alluded to, but I think didn't outright say, is that we're using unexplainable models to explain unexplainable models, even in traditional data science. And so extrapolating that to, you know, to this new AI post 2022 is an even bigger problem.
I think that's both of those are really key points. And, you know, I've made some recent posts and actually kind of allude to it in my book, where if you kind of look at what we've been doing, Seth, over the last and team over the last 3 or 4 years or so around AI, the trustworthy AI and the responsible AI or responsible categorization, if you will, or the need for it in this space is not new, right? We've been working in that space and we know how difficult it has been. And do we know some of the reasons? Well, generative AI, for me, as was said earlier, makes it even more difficult, because even with the models that we've been building over the years, and I'm like, pick a model, pick an industry and pick a model, they're typically data that was already curated inside of whatever that industry was, right? And because it didn't necessarily need the extreme amount of data in order to get to an outcome. And even that was an issue, right? Even that small group of data that was needed to participate in an outcome. So now you add generative AI to it. So things like explainability, things about like transparency, right? The bias, we talk about disparate impact and disparate treatment, to me is even a bigger issue. It's almost one of those terminologies where you lose it in the context. So you say the good is so good that there's no way for me to spend time on responsible and trustworthiness of it. Whereas when we were just talking about predictive AI, that in itself was big enough for us to stop, look, and listen. Generative AI, I fear that we're not spending enough time on those topics.
Yeah, I was just going to add that I think one of the things that's interesting is this convergence of generative AI with other advances in like AI alignment, right? That's what makes them sound really convincing, right? And while it may sound real, it actually may not be. And there's actually essentially a trade-off between being kind of more creative, but then you may potentially have more hallucinations, but also, you know, more possibilities, right? So when, for example, in my lab, we're, you know, let's say we're working on drug design, it may make something that looks like a molecule, but it may get the format wrong a little bit, you know, if you get it to be too creative. I was working on a book with a student that was made based on generative AI in writing the book. And there you may want to be more creative, right? But at some point, you know, the English may not start to sound right, right? So there's a lot of parameters to think about. But I think what's interesting is now we have that capability of having something that sounds pretty, you know, sounds realistic. And so there's a lot of possibilities once you have something like that to keep people engaged in conversations. And that's what I think could make a big difference in healthcare, right? Because in the past, it was really hard to keep people engaged because it, you know, it just didn't sound real. And now we're at the point where it is convincing.
Wow. Yeah, that was a great set of responses. this is a pretty impressive panel, I have to say. I have these kinds of conversations frequently. And I think just on that one question, that was a pretty comprehensive in many ways set of points. So it does bring another point up. And Seth, you mentioned this a little bit on the data side, where you know the data that these models are trained on, as generative AI proliferates, the hunger and the appetite for more and more data, large data sets, is growing. And I think we're seeing that already start to creep into changes and evolution in terms of service. Where in any situations where people are, you know, submitting their data, and in healthcare, of course, with PHI, this is always a huge concern, and always one of the biggest questions of risk and governance is maintaining patient privacy. I wonder if any of you have any thoughts on this area with more and more, you know, sort of appetite for data, for training larger models. What impact is this going to have on the healthcare industry?
Well, I think it's almost inevitably going to have an impact, particularly in the context of telehealth. So, you know, back in August, Zoom, our favorite platform, one we're using to record this panel right now, changed their terms of service to allow all of the video content passing through their platform to be used to train and retrain their own models, and had changed those terms of service sort of underneath the hood, if you will, not through advisory to everyone that their terms of service were changing. And there was enormous backlash to that, and Zoom walked back that policy change and required consent, affirmative opt-in consent to the use of data for that purpose. But if you think about the giant gaping jaw of hunger for that data, companies are inevitably going to pursue that objective, right? More data equals more powerful models, better and more predictive models, et cetera. And so I think there's kind of two sides to that equation then. How do we as companies behave in a responsible way and requirements for ourselves to think about how we collect and use and repurpose and sell data? And on the consumer side, how are consumer protections being built in to the various data protection regimes that exist and are forthcoming, particularly related to AI, that will offer some consumer protections, which are that much more critical in a health or telehealth context.
But just one clarification on that. Zoom has not updated their terms of service. That was just a statement they made.
No.
I checked this morning, so which is meaningless because by using this, we're still agreeing to them. So regardless of what they said. I think there's opportunity to use this technology responsibly. So for instance, in the UK, the UK NHS, or specifically NHS England, trained a large language model, so a generative AI model, specifically on data that they held. And so it is a proprietary model for the most part, where it has personal health information in it. They have made some of the data sets public. So I think there's opportunity for organizations especially in highly regulated industries, but I think you'll see this more broadly, to train their own models, from scratch. Even 3 months ago, that was inordinately expensive. There was just an acquisition in this space of a company called Mosaic ML by Databricks for $1.3 billion. The whole premise of Mosaic ML is they can train a model from scratch for less than $500,000. So we're going to see widespread adoption of these. But regardless, in the healthcare space, I think the best place to start are with non-direct healthcare situations. So think direct patient situations. So for instance, helping physicians get a better handle on their notes. So instead of walking into a visit with a patient, and having to flip through their chart while they're sitting there, can they get a brief before they go in about what's relevant for that patient? You could use generative AI and for scheduling, for helping to schedule, different facilities, operating rooms, supplies. There's tons of kind of back office, if you will, applications for generative AI to build trust with the physician community and with the patient community before we start putting these in patient decisions. Because I think you'll see two things. One is in the US and most of the world, as soon as it touches a patient, it's a medical device. And so regulatory burden is going to be, impossible for right now because we don't even know what that looks like. And two, physicians aren't going to use it because they don't trust it. I think that's the biggest barrier for medical technology is the physician. Second biggest barrier is the insurers don't pay for it. And so, we're seeing that with some of these weight loss drugs where regardless of the health benefits, insurers are really not paying for it. So I think those are some of the opportunities and some of the challenges with this technology in coming into AI for healthcare.
Yeah, I'll just add to that. I see several issues. Privacy is the one that you mentioned earlier, and it's like, I think for me, just the whole concept, when you think about how we've defined, even on this call, what AI, predictive AI is and what generative AI is, this whole concept of needing lots of data to come to an outcome, to get your accuracy rate up to where, as said so eloquently stated, that some sponsor, right, a physician or healthcare professional or stakeholder is going to trust or accept the outcome. So in order to do that, you need an accuracy rate. And that's irregardless or irrespect to this whole concept around being responsible, right? Most of these applications are not, the designers are not spending a whole lot of time determining whether or not they are trustworthy or not. It's the accuracy rate that they're after. In order to get that, you need lots of data. That's just statistical 101. You need lots of data in order to get the training model to get an accuracy rate. Well, in order to get that data, privacy is a big issue because you'll see people cheating the system to get the data. They'll incent people to get the data in ways where people would think that they are not really they're not losing anything to get the data. Because at the end of the day, you got to have the data, otherwise you don't get the accuracy rate. So my issue is the privacy piece is a big component almost on every application that we do when it comes to generative AI. And so you start seeing companies like the one Seth or organizations like the one Seth talked about around what we call in the industry curated data. So ChatGPT, everything that Seth talked about earlier was built on uncurated data, going off, pulling data in an uncurated manner. Well, in healthcare, we spent years building curated models. We call them healthcare models. So lots of data, lots of models exist. So there is a value prop, if you will, when people are building generative AI types of models around data that they own, data that they that are already. That doesn't mean that they're not going to have some of the issues or many of these issues that we're talking about here. But you do have an opportunity, if you're going to do it anyway, right? If the idea is around generative AI, the value prop for doing so, right? For doing so, the optimization and the dollars associated with it is so big, you're going to do it anyway, then at least look at the curated data model component and making sure that you can get your arms around the data models and the data, the taxonomies that you have in play. And then you're still going to run into some of these issues that we've been talking about here today, even if you do that, right?
I think one of the things we'll see with this change potentially in terms of service and so forth in the healthcare industry is that I think it'll be back to more having more personalized engagement in the kind of user interfaces and so forth that, potentially have, some things that may come as side effects from that as well. There may be, it may lead to either earlier triaging before interacting with other people or more telehealth type of experiences as you are able to gather more information right at the beginning because you're kind of analyzing it right when they're using the systems to throughout their engagement process. So I think that's one thing we'll see. I think, if you look at these pre-trained models, they can be quite large. They could be designed to be for very specific use cases if you're able to do this for different specialties. So some areas where there may be many maybe a rare condition that often you don't have enough information for, by having a lot of these pieces of information that you can put together, you may be able to actually have the AI make recommendations that otherwise you may not have been able, a physician or someone may not have seen a patient like that for a large for a large period of time as just one example. But these cases in general, I think in healthcare, where you have kind of a rare case, whether it be a catastrophic case, whether it be a rare side effect that you don't see very often, I think these could be potentially found by having these models with more and more data that is accrued in ways that you weren't specifically planning to gather it, because these rare events, you didn't really plan on it, right? You have to be keeping gathering it, and that's what these terms, that could be one potential benefit of that.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting point. We often have unintended consequences of certain things happening in industry or sometimes accelerating rapidly. And sometimes those unintended consequences are negative, but not always. Sometimes we find some positive opportunities as well. It's interesting you mentioned telehealth too, as kind of a potential area that may be impacted by the desire for more data. I had a telehealth company, almost 10 years ago. And, this was a question we always thought about. Will we get to a point where patient encounters are going to be regularly recorded, on all these systems? Because when you're recording that, you're now capturing all these interactions that normally don't get captured, right? You don't normally fully capture exactly the interaction as it happens in the office. There are some notes that are taken afterwards, but you don't capture everything, as well as the potential for, the more predictive side of AI to identify conditions just based on, on audio coming from the patient, or the video, being able to identify likelihood of risk, for certain types of things, as well as getting some, what is more and more sophisticated data now, where you can get heart rate, you can get blood pressure just from, this is a video of somebody, right? So there is a tremendous potential for data in telehealth interactions, but I don't know, you know, when a roof will get to the point where, you know, providers or health systems or their lawyers are comfortable with having all encounters recorded. But in a way, I always thought that would maybe actually be a positive thing in the sense that, you know, it would actually create more accountability and help us to improve care delivery and, you know, advance innovation in medical science further. But there are just so many other restrictions, you know, that we've touched on a bit here that probably, you know, maybe won't allow us to make that happen in at least the near future, but we'll see.
Hey, before we move on, Dennis, I want to kind of come back to something you said and something Gil said. So, you know, when you think about conversational interactions that are non-human with anyone, there's a study out of Cambridge not too long ago that found that when humans know they're talking to an AI, they're more honest. And so, you know, you think about medication compliance, you think about mental illness, you think about, you know, diseases, you know, are you exercising like you told your doctor? You know, those are things where, you know, you might get more honest responses if those are triaged, you know, before a call. And then you also have the other challenge with some of these rare diseases that Gil mentioned, in that there's some populations that just are tremendously underrepresented in the healthcare system. And so the problem gets exacerbated when you're talking about, you know, a lack of data from certain populations, particularly the Black and Brown population in the US. Then you have diseases that are prevalent at less than 0.1%. You know, that's a combination for, you know, of lack of data that's ripe for, you know, a lot of issues or propagating a lot of issues.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, maybe, following up on that a little bit, and also some of the things you said, Gil, when we think of applications in clinical environments, specifically, you know, to address specific disease states, conditions, whether diagnosis or treatment, what kinds of things should we think of from a governance perspective and more broadly, when it comes to clinical validation of AI applications?
You know, when I think of this, I think the biggest challenge in kind of self and regulation, I think we're getting a little bit into, you know, industry self-regulating. And I think when we look at this technology or technology in general, industries have no choice but to self-regulate for a time being, because, you know, policymakers, you know, in the U.S. Congress, outside the U.S., it's typically parliaments of some kind, are woefully uneducated in technology, right? I think we have one scientist in the U.S. Congress overall today. They are completely unequipped, and most of them have no desire to learn anything about this field beyond making themselves look good on TV.
And I find their staff tends to not be very well equipped either, unfortunately.
Right. So very, very good point. And so, you know, industry has no issue to, you know, no, has no choice but to do this, you know, but I think at the same time, we need to start thinking about pushing our lawmakers, both in the US and other parts of the world, to create an FAA or FDA like organization to regulate generative AI and AI particularly. I like the FAA better than the FDA, because the FAA figures out how to do things. The FDA tends to slow things down. But I think we need some, you know, policy body, some governance body of made up of experts. This field is moving so fast today, it changes weekly, literally, that, you know, experts have trouble keeping up, let alone, you know, pages to policymakers who are, you know, trying to, you know, get ahead in the political world. So I think that's one aspect. I think that is a very risky situation for this technology. If we looked at what happened with social media, the industry was saying we'll self-regulate. Well, look where we are now with hate, misinformation, with all of these things going rampant through social media. I think most people, vast majority of people would agree we don't want the same issues existing in AI with AI, let alone propagated by AI. We have elections coming up all around the world that this technology will likely impact, because there are no regulations about the use of it. And you know, I think it's just as dangerous, if not more dangerous, in healthcare for inappropriate use. I think luckily in healthcare, we have HIPAA in the US that protects patient rights. And I think the audience watching this understands that better than the general public, but it typically only applies to provider and payer interaction with the patient, doesn't really apply outside that situation. So, that's a risky situation as well when people give their health information to people that are not directly responsible for their healthcare in some way. They have no obligation under HIPAA, and that opens up a big can of worms for patient data getting out in the real world without them realizing that's even a possibility.
When I look at this whole topic, especially if we've moved to the whole conversation of self-regulation and government regulation, although I'm optimistic or I'm hopeful, I'm not optimistic. Because when you really think about it, right, folk like us who build these systems, there's so much money involved in AI. AI basically are helping companies create efficiencies and reducing costs and creating new revenue opportunities. And whenever that is the case, you're going to struggle with getting people to say, I want to do the right thing at the cost. In order to do some of this stuff that we're talking about, that we're posting and Skyping and Slacking and LinkedIn and about, it's hard stuff and it costs money. And whenever it costs money, people tend to vote with their pocketbooks. So when I think of regulations, and we've seen it done before. We've seen the FDA regulate simple things like labels on when you go to a store and pick up, your favorite product, where they specify specifically what those ingredients were. That was done for a reason, because prior to that, people would cheat the system. They would say something did not have sugar in it when it was full of sugar. It would say it did not have a whole lot of carbs and it was full of carbs, right? So you needed government to come in and to regulate it, right? But this is different. AI is different because it's even different than HIPAA, because HIPAA was just a program to come and say, we're going to protect people's data. There wasn't necessarily a whole lot of money at stake on this, but to ingest these conversations into these development environments that we've all been a part of. And again, by the way, I'm speaking for myself now. I'm not speaking for any particular company on these comments that I'm making. It costs money. It disrupts productivity. It makes a project that was going to be completed in 3 months now get completed in 9 months. In order to go through these processes, there's a dollar sign associated to that. So people tend not to want to do it. And the lobbyists and the government, even though they say they will do it, my question is, when I say I'm not optimistic, I want to wait and see, because it's going to take a whole lot in order to fix this problem. I believe that healthcare is in a very unique opportunity, has a very unique opportunity, simply because of the structure of healthcare today. You already have a lot of peer review evidence. Like, typically the nature of healthcare is that people go and ask for second and third and fourth opinions. In other areas, they don't. Now, please.
So let me modify the question a little bit, maybe to being, can healthcare specifically be successful in self-regulation, as opposed to maybe other industries? And let me give just a little bit of context. So Seth, you mentioned tech. Tech has been kind of the Wild West, and we shouldn't be surprised that tech has failed to regulate itself, especially with social media in that sense. But earlier in my career, I was an investment banker. I was also an asset manager, and I had to get licensed by what was originally, when I started, still NAS, the National Association of Securities Dealers, and eventually became what is today FINRA, Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, which is basically a self-regulatory organization that sort of sits between industry and the SEC and regulatory bodies. But it's self-regulated by the industry. And it grew up largely as a result of, perhaps some similar Wild West type concerns in finance historically. And, Calvin, you mentioned when you're dealing with something that's, high growth and you're talking about high potential for profits and things like that, obviously finance, the financial markets are very much like that and needed to be reined in. But ultimately, what the industry settled on was, was a framework that was largely self-regulatory, but that issues licenses, that does investigations, that's, very proactive and very strict about kicking people out whenever, any types of violations are brought to their attention. You know, the SEC tends to enforce things that are more serious and, sort of at larger scale. It's mostly attorneys that are working there. But the financial self-regulatory organization, to me, has always seemed like a potential model for healthcare. And one of the reasons for that, going back to Seth's point earlier, that government just doesn't seem to be well equipped. Our legislators, there's too much of a gap in knowledge in terms of the complexity of these technologies and the speed at which they're proliferating, that in many ways, the industry itself is really kind of best positioned to decide what's appropriate for us in healthcare, and what isn't, and where those boundaries ought to be set. I'm personally, and these are just opinions, obviously a lot of very smart people on this call, and we're going to have different perspectives to some extent, and I respect that and very interested to hear everyone's thoughts on this. Maybe there is more room for government, but at least from my experience, it seems like we maybe have more potential for self-regulatory structure at this stage and the earlier stages than a federal agency that's going to be, stood up and suddenly ready to do this in the right way.
So I think we have no choice in the near term to self-regulate, but I think, tech people from tech are going to come in this industry. You saw that with financial services, with Robinhood, right? Robinhood completely blew up the stock market. The SEC had no regulations to address it. They still don't really. And so you're going to see similar things, I'm predicting, in healthcare. Where people are taking healthcare data and doing inappropriate things with it, maybe not collecting it in ethical ways, but still legal. Kind of like I mentioned, people assuming it's all their healthcare data is protected under HIPAA. So if they're giving data to one of these companies, they have rights that they don't have. So I would be very surprised if we didn't see situations like that arising, which I know are technically outside the industry.
But very fair points. I agree with you, Seth.
But I think we need
a potential vector and a risk.
We need an expert body. It's just not going to be stood up fast enough. So we have no choice but to have the industry regulate itself.
And there are known approaches for doing that, even in the healthcare system writ large, right? So if you think about, randomized controlled trials to validate, going back to your original question, Dennis, right, about clinical validation, right? The gold standard is randomized controlled trials, right? And peer-reviewed research. They certainly have their limitations, but they're an incredibly powerful tool, right? Medical AI systems have been subjected to very few of those. And the difference between how these systems perform in a lab versus how they perform in a clinic can be great, particularly when, say, in a lab, you are dealing with, as Seth has raised as a point earlier, patients from very different populations or images from very different hospital systems with varying degrees of accuracy and precision in even their medical imaging, right? So if we were able to standardize and harmonize some of those already existing approaches and bridge the gap between the lab and the clinic with those existing approaches for the medical system, I think we would go very far in taking a step toward what you're describing, Dennis, which is that self-regulatory approach.
And yeah, we have a foundation for it. Mm-hmm.
And ultimately landing a place where we have an FDA or FTC or FAA-like body that has the technical expertise to govern this from a top-down standpoint.
I mean, one of the things, right, when you kind of look at this whole self-regulatory perspective, right, and the reason that I think we all agree that healthcare is can be a kind of a leader in this space, if you will, is because in healthcare you already kind of align with this concept of societal values and norms, where the government is all about the law, what's legal, and whereas healthcare has traditionally, right? I mean, I challenge it historically, but traditionally, it has been concerned with the societal values and norms, meaning certain things that it just doesn't feel right to do. So therefore, we'll build our we'll self-regulate around those societal norms and values, whereas government has a bigger burden in its sense, whereas everything has to be policy, everything has to be legal. And to get a guideline to become policy is a hard thing to do in the world that we live in today, because there's lots of money, lots of different perspectives around that. So, you know, when you're dealing with things like privacy, data privacy, and societal values, what's good, what feels good around fairness and transparency, I do believe that healthcare industry in itself can be more aggressive, or should be more aggressive in this space. That way, we'll push the government to do more. I think if you wait for the government to do it and not self-regulate, I think we'll be waiting a lot longer.
Yeah, some great perspectives there. Thank you. So we're kind of getting close to the end of our time. I did want to ask another question and then give each of you a couple of minutes just to give any closing thoughts. And the question I wanted to ask, sort of in line with our conference and some of the other bigger question is around telehealth. What are some of the opportunities that you're all seeing or thinking about at the intersection of AI and telehealth specifically? You know, or in what ways can AI, lead to more innovations in healthcare and more capability in telehealth and more capabilities in telehealth?
I mean, the whole concept, right, around having these AI solutions provide, just simply, like, let's just take a doctor, hoping that doctor provide a greater interaction with his patients and making recommendations real time. Right. So at a net, we've seen that, right? We're working on applications today where we know that in the industry, there's a nursing shortage. It's a huge nursing shortage. I mean, it's just known in the industry that COVID in particular moved it. There was a shortage prior to COVID. Now that COVID has happened over the last 2 years or so, the gap has gotten wider. So using, I think Seth or someone said earlier around these virtual nursing assistants, using NLP to ask and answer questions is a good thing, especially for people who look like me, people of color, right? We might not go to the doctor as much, but the nursing industry has been our best friends. We spend lots of time. You'll find people because it's a cheaper alternative, right? You will see some of these major organizations, companies will say, hey, you can't see a doctor, but you can see a nurse, right? So having a shortage of nursing for people of color is catastrophic in a sense, especially for people who many times don't go to doctors anyway. So having, you know, a model or an app that's going to provide a virtual set of advice 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at a lower cost pain point, right? So now you're looking at, like, it's not just a chat box, right? That's not a chat. For me, that doesn't do a whole lot, right? But a nursing or a nursing assistant is a big thing. And then, I mean, you know, I like the remote patient and monitoring piece, right? Typically, you know, you will have sometimes folk who have heart issues, you have a monitor on you. And typically the way it works is that you wear your monitor for 15 days. I know I've worn one. You wear your monitor for a couple of weeks and then you give it to your doctor after that. And then he analyzed historical what happened in those 2 weeks. Well, AI allows them to do it real time. It's so much data. Can you imagine how much data is coming out for that device? And typical analytics systems can't deal with that. But AI is uniquely positioned to be able to crunch and analyze lots of data at rapid speeds in order to make sense of it, right? So things like remote patient monitoring and engagement. We've been talking about this whole concept of automated health records analysis. That's just in itself. Being able to have a profile or follow me around 360 degrees and give me a profile and then analyze my health records real time, in a real time type of environment. That's what AI is built for. That's what it's meant for. So doing that in a very ethical and responsible way is going to provide life-saving value, which is kind of what healthcare is really all about, saving lives and prolonging life, right? At least that's how I see it.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm with Calvin on all of the applications, and I am deeply concerned with all of them as the ethical AI guy, right? Mm-hmm. That they all will ultimately suffer from the same set of issues we've been circling around here, right? Which is representativeness of the data, inherent biases in that data by who and who is not included as at the population and individual level from those resources, and some of the even just technological barriers to accessing those technologies in the first place, for those who might not have equal access to technology, to broadband or Wi-Fi, et cetera, right? So when you think about remote patient monitoring, yes, and we know from lots of research that those monitoring devices are less accurate for people with darker skin tones. They are less accurate in monitoring blood oxygen saturation and other, blood pressure, all those sorts of things. Mental health apps and virtual mm-hmm. nursing assistants. Issues of accuracy and bias there are certainly going to be present. And so the question becomes, and this was where, you know, Calvin wrapped up, but it's where I begin, which is, how do you do that in a responsible and ethical way? How do you deploy?
I don't necessarily think that I end there and you start there because I just meant
in your remarks, not as a position in life, just in terms of your remarks.
This is the assumption that I make, right? The assumption that I make is that we're going to spend time doing it right. Right. And we're going to spend time. So my assumption is every application, right? And I mean, I think the team will agree that every application that we can even envision has a propensity of being biased. And for people of color, I say in one of the posts that I made that when things go wrong for people of color, they go drastically wrong. So if you get Murphy's Law, whenever something goes wrong, it will, right? For people of color, it goes drastically wrong. So I agree with you. I agree that every one of these applications that I talk to, heck, for that reason, every application that we could think of right now has a propensity of being critically biased toward people of color. So I think that with that said, we can't stop or thwart innovation because it's going to happen anyway. It has continuously happened. So for folk like me and folk like you and the people who are on this panel, I know Seth has spent the last 3 or 4 years spearheading and leading this whole conversation. I know because I work for him doing this exact same thing. We all agree that the responsibleness and the trustworthiness of this technology is as important as the accuracy and the applications that we are building. So the idea is that as we take this opportunity on this platform to say, hey, the goal is for us to build it correctly, to spend the time, money, thought leadership, and cost in order to do it correctly. So I've said all that to say I'm in agreement with you.
Wonderful. Well, we're getting towards the end of our time here. Unless anyone has something really quick they want to add on this last point, we can move towards our closing remarks. And I think we can probably just go in the same order. So, let's maybe everybody take 2 to 3 minutes. Any closing thoughts? You know, we talked about a lot of things here, you know, trade-offs between accuracy and responsibility and the risks of rapid growth and different industries and different industries coming together and the intersection of tech and healthcare and what challenges does that pose and participation in government or self-regulatory organizations and all the topics around governance broadly. So would love to get any of your final remarks on what you'd like our participants and listeners to come away with. So Calvin, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think you said the key words, rapid growth. None of us, this train has already left the station, right? The value proposition around the technology is overwhelming. My parting thoughts is to say, hey, since we know that, we have to build it, design it, deploy it responsibly. That takes a lot of effort, and it's not a one-time thing. It's not that you go off and decide that I want to do it responsibly, because as someone said earlier, data tends to drift. And what was responsibly built on day one, on day 20, is riddled with biases. There are ways, there are thought leadership, there are normative guidance that we have determined that if you do it, if not getting rid of it altogether, I don't think you can do that. I'm a big proponent that culture and the culture that we live in has as much to do with the biases that we have than the data that we say that we have or that we collect. So I don't think we're going to ever get rid of it, because AI was meant to mimic human behavior. And I say, what behavior is that? Because this behavior that we have as human is filled with biases. So with that said, I do believe that there are things and techniques that we can do, which will cost money, that will help the process. And if you do that, the folk who will get hurt, because I say there's somebody at the end of those bias applications that are getting hurt. It's not a LinkedIn post. There are people who are actually getting hurt when we build bias applications. So there are ways, I believe, that we should be attentive. I think we should just be intentional about building the apps that are being rapidly deployed.
Fantastic. Thank you. Yoav?
Yeah, I've said a lot. So let me just end with this. I'm extremely bullish about the potential for AI in a clinical and healthcare setting. I think the territory that we have yet to chart is extremely exciting. And I am by no means, a pessimist when it comes to the potential for AI to have a positive benefit on society. At the same time, I have to check my own impulses for techno-solutionism. AI is not magic, and it will not solve all of our healthcare challenges just by sprinkling a little generative AI on top of it. So I just caution us all to like rein back our optimism and meet it with a little bit of, you know, cynicism or pessimism, or at least in interrogation of the assumptions that we are taking in that exciting building phase that we are currently in.
Thank you. Gil?
I think I would echo most of that enthusiasm as well, but also say that I think some of the areas that have a lot of this excitement in the near term may not be sort of that shiny object type thing, you know, that we've been thinking about, that or that people typically think about in the healthcare setting, whether it be, you know, can we diagnose something more efficiently or, you know, do new prognostic information, but rather might be more mundane things like administrative items and things like that within the healthcare setting, you know. But I think those are the ones that actually might affect even more patients, right? Because it's not diagnosing a certain subpopulation, but it could affect all patients, right? In all cases, I think there's one additional thing to really think about when deploying, which maybe we didn't talk about directly, but really testing in the workflow is kind of one thing that I think is very important and in some sense a little unique to the healthcare setting in terms of how important it is. So it's actually just little things like someone needing to sign on an extra time might actually prevent them from leveraging an AI tool, or having it in the workflow, I think when you're doing that testing is really going to be important in terms of adoption and potential engagement.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Seth, we'll give you the last word.
Well, a lot of pressure to wrap up this great, great conversation. So first of all, it was really great to have this conversation with all of you, very knowledgeable people in the space. So really, really appreciate it. I think there's this is a great technology we have today. But I do think there are some serious issues that in general, and especially in regulated spaces where a lot of sensitive, personal sensitive information is there, there's a lot of issues that were well known by its creators that they're probably somewhat, if not totally irresponsible, releasing it into the wild at this point. I mean, we've been using it under, you know, closed beta for 5 years before they released it. So they were well aware of the issues. But I think that's out in the wild. There's nothing we can do about it now. We just need to make sure that as, you know, as a humanity, we use it appropriately, as an industry, we use it appropriately. And I think, you know, all these bad things that we see in any AI in terms of bias, hate, misogyny, you know, AI is just a mirror of humanity because it learns from us. If you don't like it, it's your fault. Change your behavior and encourage those around you to change their behavior. I mean, that's blunt, but that's really the way it is. It's just a reflection of us. But with that said, you know, like Yoav, I'm very bullish on the power of this technology, but I think also like Yoav being, you know, in charge of responsible AI for a company as large as an influential Salesforce, I think we have a lot of work to do to make sure that this technology is implemented in an appropriate and responsible manner in general, but especially in healthcare. And I do think there's a lot of opportunity to use this technology to actually make people's lives better. Calvin and Gil both hit on some of those. And I think we're in a great time. We're seeing change at a rate that we've never seen in humanity before. And we need to embrace it, but embrace it and control it in a way that it heads in the right direction.
Absolutely. Well, with that, I want to say thank you again to our incredible panelists. You're all brilliant people, very accomplished. So we're really grateful you were able to join us. I learned a tremendous amount from this conversation, enjoyed it, and I'm sure our participants did as well. So thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Thank you.